translate any terms that need to be done. What I'll do is just, I'm going to show you a little presentation, a little video from the Chief Rabbi. Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks was a major inspiration behind this project, and I think he better than me can say it, so hopefully you can see. It's on full volume, so hopefully it's loud enough. In 1993, and again you may ask what brings me to be sitting at a table in Chicago in Highland Park, 5,000 miles away from my place of birth of London. And it all began in 1993, and Jewish belief is nothing happens by accident, that everything has a reason. And I at the time was studying university, and I came back down to my hometown in London, and my rabbi, who I'd never really thought of as somebody who could relate to students or relate to my kind of generation, said to me he had an idea maybe I could use or look at. So he said to me to come to his house, and I remember very vividly sitting in his armchair in his dining room as he was getting me something, thinking to myself, what's he going to show me? It's not going to be anything, but you look, out of respect, he's a rabbi, better respect him, I'll stay. He gave me a newspaper article, and I read it in silence about 10 minutes. When I put that newspaper article down, I realized I'd read something very unique, and I believed there was something I had to do with it. What was the article? It was an article written about a rabbi called Rabbi Shapiro. Rabbi Shapiro was an ordinary guy who unfortunately was taken with his family to the concentration camps, where his family pretty much was wiped out. He himself survived and moved after the war to Israel, to a small village near Netanya in the north of Israel. In 1985, to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the end of the Holocaust, he was invited to represent the Haredi or the Hasidic groups who'd been wiped out during the Holocaust by the UJA, who were commemorating in Theresienstadt a large memorial for 40 years since the end of the Holocaust. He went along. He was asked to do two things. He was asked first to light a candle in memory of the 6 million, and then to stand for a minute's silence for the 6 million. He did what he was told. He lit the candle, and he stood back in silence. During that minute, two thoughts struck him. The first was, it was easy enough for him to remember the dark years of 39 to 45. He had lived through that nightmare. What about his children? What about his grandchildren? How would they remember? How could they possibly understand what he'd been through? But secondly, and more worryingly, was another thought that struck him during that minute. Is this a Jewish way of remembering? Being quiet. He went back to Israel, went to Yad Vashem, which was in those days, in its early stages, not quite the organization we know it is today. And he asked from their database for the names of 30 children, aged between 6 and 12, who had been killed in the Holocaust. They gave him the details, and he went back to his hometown, and went to the local cheder, or local school, and gathered 30 young boys together who were aged between 6 and 12, and said to the boys, I'm going to give you a card, I'll give you a name of somebody who was your age, had probably your hopes, your dreams, but unfortunately was killed before they had a chance to realize those dreams. And he gave the name to each of the kids. He said the transformation that these children went under was remarkable. They felt a responsibility for the person they were learning in memory of. And more than that, they felt a sense of destiny, that here they were, Jewish kids in the state of Israel, 30, 40, 50 years on, learning in memory of people who never had the chance. The article then went on to say that in 1993, 8 years after this beginning of this project, there was a Siyum. What is a Siyum? A Siyum is the learning, the celebration of learning of some part of Jewish learning. What was a Siyum that the article spoke of, the Rabbi Shapiro had organized, was a Siyum of the learning of 6 million Mishnayot. A Mishnah is a traditional thing that Jews learn in memory of somebody, of a loved one. The reason why Mishnah, the word Mishnah has the letters Mem, Shin, Nun, Hei, which spells the word Neshama as well, Nun, Shin, Mem, which means a Jewish soul. And it's traditional when you're sitting Shiva, or whatever it is, you learn a Mishnah in memory of your loved one. These children were asked by Rabbi Shapiro to learn Mishnayot, not for any loved one they related to, but for their person, for their child, for their student. 20,000 of these students over the period of 8 years had learned collectively 6 million Mishnayot. And that was their Siyum, to celebrate the learning of 6 million Mishnayot. And at this Siyum, Rabbi Shapiro, who was a survivor of the Holocaust, took out a shofar that he had smuggled into Bergen-Belsen and blown in Rosh Hashanah there. And he blew the shofar proudly in Yerushalayim at this Siyum. And he writes in the article how, looking around, he said, the last time he said he blew the shofar was in the depth of hell. He was now blowing it with 20,000 Jewish children looking at him. And he felt in some ways that he was doing all, I guess, in full circle in a positive way. And the article finished up to say it was basically an article about this seal that had happened in Jerusalem. Finished the article, my rabbi said to me, he says, Andrew, I think this is a way to do this for students. I think there's a way. I'll leave it to you to work out what it is. Have a good evening. And I went away and I thought, he's right. What was he saying to me? He was saying to me, I don't understand students. I am whatever it is. He was then in his late 60s. I don't get what's going on nowadays. But you do. You're a student. You know this. As it happened at the time, I was working in UJS. UJS is the Union of Jewish Students. with all the campus college campuses across the UK. But there was two main problems I had with this idea. The first is, learning is a wonderful, wonderful thing, but you've got to have the knowledge to learn. Jewish students don't know what a Mishnah is. Most of them can't even read Hebrew. How do you ask Jews to learn if they can't learn? And secondly, time. Just learn. Well, for a little Hasidic kid, that's what they do with their life. They learn, thank God. How do you tell a student with no background, just learn, well, when? How long for? A minute? A day? It doesn't matter. Things happened, and I remember once going into somebody's office in London, telling about the idea. He says to me, lovely idea, he says, but you've got to focus it. You've got to focus their learning. So I said to him, what, like 50 days for 50 years? Because it was then 1995. He said, exactly. It's a lovely idea. So the idea of learning for a period of time, for the years that had gone by, and then it was, what do they learn? We realized they couldn't learn Mishnah Yad, they couldn't learn advanced Jewish topics, but they could learn things they wanted to learn. So we sent out a fax. Emails didn't exist back in the 20th century, or not quite yet. We said to students, please send in your questions, your comments. What do you want to know about? What are the areas of Jewish life you want to know about? And the questions came in. Why should we keep kosher? What is Shabbat? Belief in God. Belief in God after the Holocaust. Life after death. The Mashiach. We said, great. And we then faxed to some of the top rabbis and educators world over. These have questions. Said to these people, please ask the questions. And sure enough, answers came in. And in 1995, this little booklet was born, which was called 50 Days, 50 Years, with a strapline member of the past to build the future. We gave this book out to 5,000 students up and down campuses, with a simple idea, which each day to learn one essay a day for 50 days in memory of a student. We got the names of Yad Vashem of 5,000 students who died in the Holocaust. The same idea as Rabbi Shapiro did, just not learn Mishnayot and not learn it all year, just for 50 days, for 7 weeks. We sent it out. We really didn't know what sort of response we'd get. Within a few days we knew. The stories that came up of people reading it in their lounges, at the pubs, at the clubs, because little pocketbook, they took it with them. I remember a story of going to one student's house. They were going to have a special session to learn the book one evening. The session finished at 4 a.m. One student said to me, I used to always spend my night up drinking. I spent this night up learning. This is a kid, you know, didn't have a yarmulke on, nothing, earring, but he connected. He connected, why? Because it was something that he could relate to, he could understand. To me, the most powerful story came in the last week of the project. This is in 1995. We held a Shabbaton in London, in Hillow House. Hillow House, I'm sure you have them here in America. It's a chance for students to get together. And we invited anyone who'd taken part in the project in London to come together to celebrate the ending of the project, something I know that Zev hopes to do later on this year. 300 students replied, and we had a massive hall full of students enjoying and celebrating Shabbat together. And I got up and I spoke about the project, how successful it had been, and how I felt people had really learned from it. And I walked down the table saying Shabbat Shalom, Shabbat Shalom, Shabbat Shalom, and a young lady stopped me with a foreign accent. She said to me, excuse me, you're Andrew Shaw, yeah? I said, yes. She says, and you and your team, UJS, you did the book. I said, yes. She goes, well, thank you. I said, it's a pleasure, what for? She says, thank you for making me a Jew. I said, excuse me? She said, thank you for making me a Jew. I said, you're going to have to explain what on earth that means. She said, I'll explain. She says, I'm French, born in Paris. My grandmother and grandfather were killed at Auschwitz. My mother, who survived, believed, or I think she was born, I know her grandmother died at Auschwitz, her grandfather survived, and the mother was born in Paris, and then she was born. My mother believed there was nothing positive in being Jewish. She was too scared to raise me as a Jew because of what she had heard from her parents or grandmother. My mother obviously had died in the Holocaust, and she raised me as a non-Jew. I came here this year to England as part of my work experience. I finished school. I have a gap year now before I start university in France, in Paris. And I started work for a year in the UK. I speak reasonable English, and I asked for a job as a nanny, as an au pair. And I got a job. It just happened, and I use the word happened with a very huge amount of commas, I just happened to be given a job in a Jewish home, who just happened to have a Jewish student, who just happened to go to Leeds, who just happened to do the project, just happened to come home one Shabbat, and happened to leave the book on the dining room table when I came in that Friday afternoon. She said, I picked up the book, She said, I noticed on the front cover a picture of a concentration camp. She said, I knew enough about the Holocaust that it was something to do with my family. So I opened the book and I began to read. She said, by page 5 I realized I was Jewish. By page 10 or 15 I realized there was something more to it than meets the eye. And she said, I read the entire book that day from start to finish. And amazingly, I think it would make a sense in this room here. She said, I decided to try and keep Shabbat that week because of Essay 10, which was an article by Rabbi Akiva Tatz, who I know some of you may have heard of. And if you read the article by Rabbi Tatz that he wrote, it's nothing to do with keeping Shabbat. It's about what Shabbat is. But nevertheless, she tried to keep Shabbat based on the essay. It didn't work, she said. I didn't really get it. That's why I'm here tonight, she said. Because this is my first Shabbat together with the community, with the student community, and my first Shabbat, hopefully, as a Jew, with the Jewish community. She said, you write in your introduction to the book, which I did, that Hitler killed 6 million Jews. She said, that's not true. He killed 6,000,001. He killed me as well. Maybe not physically, but spiritually. Because of the Holocaust, I was not a Jew. In name I was, but certainly in practice I wasn't. It's because of this book, I've now returned to the fold, and I consider myself a very proud member of the Jewish people. The story has a wonderful ending, as most stories should have. I met her 3 years later in Israel when I was doing my rabbinical training. She'd moved to Israel and was just got engaged. And now, as of a few years ago, she's now happily married with 3 gorgeous kids living in Yerushalayim. All because, in essence, she read a book which connected her back to Judaism. And she says to me, if only, she says, my grandfather could see now what I am, what I've become, despite what they tried to do to my family. That was 1995, and for the next 10 years I drifted. I finished my smicha, I did my rabbinical training, began an organization called Tribe, and when the 60th year came since the Holocaust, the chief rabbi said to me, I think it's about time we did this again, but this time a little bit bigger. So sure enough, we launched in January of 1995, which you just saw the video, 60 days for 60 years, across the UK, not only in students' land, but in schools, in shuls, in community centers. And with a tremendous effort from my team at Tribe and from all the rabbis and the community, we got approximately 60,000 Jews up and down the UK involved in the project. The stories that we heard from the grapevine, or from the Jewish grapevine, were tremendous. You would have a situation on the local commute into London of a tube carriage of sort of 7 people buried into their books, because every Jew got it, every Jew's reading it. You'd have Jews, when they got to work, who maybe never spoke to each other. What do you think of today's essay? Did you read it? I enjoyed it. I got an email from a top executive. We're talking about, you know, he's not struggling to find his next piece of bread. He said to me, he says, Rabbi, he says, I get into my office and I'm straight into work. He says, I got this book. I said, you know what? I went to my office, locked the door, phone's off. First 10 minutes of the day, I'm going to read my essay and then I'll start my day. Transformed my work week. And people in the office said to me, wow, if you can do that, we can do that. And he says the whole office of the Jews would say, first 10 minutes of the day, shh, we're reading the book. I had family say to me, Rabbi, for the first time my grandchild is asking me, can we read it together? Family said to me they'd never done anything together. Come home from school, let's sit down, get your books open, let's read it together, let's discuss it. On different levels. Because of course what God means to us as adults is different than what it means to kids. But you know what? Let's learn it together. And one parent said to me, thank you for allowing me to at last be a parent to my child, educating them, rather than just being a pain in the neck for my child, which I am most of the time. When you think about the wider idea behind the project, to me it's twofold. And the first part of it, which means a lot to me, is this part, is the card. The card, if you look at it, has a quotation. The quotation is taken from Yad Vashem, from a letter that a man called David Berger, who was 21 years old, wrote. He wrote the following sentence. I should like someone to remember that there once lived a person named David Berger. It's a remarkable thing to write. We would never write that nowadays, because we don't need to write it. Because our kids remember us, our families, our communities, everyone gets remembered. Because unfortunately, or fortunately, as a rabbi I do it many often, I have what's called a matseva, a tombstone. I have to go to the graveside and we read the stone of the family. Why is he writing this? Because he knew what was happening in Vilna in 1941. He knew that he could any time be taken out, shot, gassed. Who would know? who would care? And he asked for a very simple thing. Remember, there once lived a person called David Berger. Hitler wasn't stupid. The Nazis weren't stupid. If we try and think Nazis were just stupid people, then we are giving a great disservice to our nation. The Nazis were insanely intelligent. They realized you want to destroy the Jewish people, you don't destroy their bodies, you destroy their souls. How do you do that? By destroying their identity. Our names are everything. And you're called different things by different people. You could be called a loved name by your spouse or your family, a nickname, but you have a name that everyone calls you. The Nazis removed that and gave us a number. You were not Mr. Cohen or Nathan Leibovitz. You were 157234, branded on your arm, a number. What this project aims to do is take 6 million numbers and make them once again 6 million names. David Berger was a number, he's now once again a name. If you look at the names in your cards, all these people were numbers. They don't have a gravestone. They don't have families visiting them. They don't have an ability for us to remember them. But now they do. Moshe Falik. Moshe Falik was one of the 6 million who probably no one would ever have heard of again. He's heard of again because, as fate would have it, the card I received when I did a project in England was Moshe Falik, age 32. Born in Krakow, he was a tailor in Poland. Never got married. He might have been engaged when he was 32, I don't know. But at 32 years old, he was taken to Mauthausen concentration camp, where he was killed. I will never forget Moshe Falik because he is my person. There are many thousands of names, as Zev said, but you know what? Moshe is my guy. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau says a phenomenal thing, and it's actually quoted in the book. You can read it in the foreword. Rabbi Lau, if you actually look, I think we can look at it here. I'll show it to you. If you look at the pictures, it's towards the back of the book. There's a wonderful picture. Page 100, so what is it? 196. Page 196, there's a picture of a young boy. That young boy is Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, who is leaving a displaced persons camp in July 45. He survived Buchenwald. He was 10 years old in this picture. He became the chief rabbi of Israel. Rabbi Lau says he couldn't talk about what he'd seen, what he'd experienced as a child. Can you imagine spending your childhood years in Buchenwald? It doesn't even... It's just too horrifying to think of. And he wouldn't talk about it. Eventually, he began to say a few stories to his family, to his friends. But he was shocked when in the 60s, the Holocaust shot to fame, or shot to sort of public consciousness, by a story, a tale of the Holocaust. And he said when he read this, he says, it's disgraceful. Where's the gas chambers? Where's the executions? This book is all about a little girl in an attic with her family from Amsterdam called Anne Frank. Why has that become a bestseller? The world needs to know about the true Holocaust. That's a story about a kid. It took him 30 years, he said, till he realized why Anne Frank became so powerful, so popular. He says, you can't relate to 6 million. Chief Rabbi says it. That's 9/11 every day for 6 years. It's just too big a number. But you can relate to one person. You can relate to Anne Frank. And that's why he believes, and I believe, and Zev believes, this project is so important. Because it's all about one person, one name. Moshe Falik is my guy. And you've been handed tonight the card, and that's your person. They were all born, I think, in Chicago, all born in Lvov, from Lvov. They may have died in Lvov, they may have died further afield. My community in London got Krakow, all up here from Krakow. And the idea is to take the vibrancy that was Lvov and recreate it here 6 years later in Chicago. Toronto last night took Lodz. Why did they take Lodz? They decided that Lodz had 240,000 Jews in Lodz before the war. That's how many Jews are in Toronto today. They wanted to say to the world, we are now recreating the vibrancy of Lodz here in Toronto. Since we did the book, we've moved It's been launched in Israel. The Maccabiah Games last year, every single participant at Maccabiah Games received a book and a card. It's been launched across America tonight, last night in Toronto, tonight in Chicago, in San Diego, Los Angeles, Providence, and Columbus, Ohio. Approximately 10,000 books have gone out in the US in this launch run. It's been launched in Australia in February, in South Africa, so it was a birthplace, in June. We worked out that the total amount of books and cards that will be distributed by sort of the middle of next year, by March 07, approximately 100,000. 100,000 Jews will have participated worldwide in this project, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing. 100,000 cards, 100,000 books, 100,000 Jews learning. But, as Yad Vashem said to me, do you realize it's only 1/60th of the names that we have to remember? 100,000 is massive! Doesn't even scratch the surface of what we have to do. During this project, I took, I was going to show you the photos, I took my kids from my shul, my year 10, 15 year olds, 25 of them to Israel. As part of the leadership course, I know Zev does a leadership course as well, we take them to Israel for 8 days. Part of our trip was to go to Yad Vashem. During the project, they all had their books, their cards, and they walked into the museum. So if you've been to Yad Vashem, there is there a children's memorial to the 1.5 million children that died in the Holocaust, a very powerful memorial. In fact, it's an essay in here, you can read about it, Rabbi Wein's opinion of it in a very beautiful way. We walked through that memorial, came out the other side into the Jerusalem sun and sat down on the stones and waited everyone to come through. The tour guide then came and said to all the children there, she says, you just walked through in quite a harsh tone, I would say. You just walked through a memorial to 1.5 million children. Name me some. She's been doing this for 20 years with groups from all around the world. She said to me after it happened, she said to me, normally they just say Anne Frank. And she says to them, that's it. 1.5 million kids, all you know is one name. My kids were different. Sitting in a line, the first kid said their person's name. Down the line, their person's their person. She looks at me, she says, what is this group? Are they children of Holocaust survivors? How do they know these names? And it wasn't just the names they said. They said, you know, so-and-so, age 15, from Krakow. They knew. And I told her. She says, in my 20 years of educating for Holocaust, never have I seen something like this. Because now these kids, and I saw my kids before I went, I said, tell me, who's your guy? And they told me, they won't forget. That's their person, one name. But I want to focus on the second part of the strap line, which is remember the past, which is this, to build the future. And that's where Rav Shapira came from. That's why he created this idea which we took and have brought into this project. Because being Jewish is not just simply remembering the past. To be a Jew is also to build the future. And what do we do in that minute silence? We don't do nothing, we remember. Because the chief rabbi writes in the first essay, which you'll hopefully read tonight, he says, when Jews remember, we remember for the future. There's a word that we probably know better than any other word in the Hebrew language, which unfortunately is the word that many Jews associate with going to shul, the word yizkor, yizkor. Everyone goes to shul for yizkor around the world. Yom Kippur yizkor is the time in my shul, you can't move. After that, it gets a bit quieter. Yizkor is packed. And yizkor is from the word zachor, to remember. There's certain words in Hebrew that don't have a word. They don't exist. We have to make up a word for them in modern Hebrew. There is no word in Judaism or Hebrew for history. History is not a Jewish word. The word for history is historia. Modern Hebrew words, take Ingrid, like televisia, historia. History doesn't exist in Judaism. Why? Because we don't have history, we have memory. History is his story. There's no Jewish history. It's Jewish memory. It's my story. The word history does not appear. The word memory, zachor, appears 165 times in the Torah, replete with yizkor, with memory. But when you look very closely, when it says remember, it's always for the future. Vayizkor lekim et Rachel, he remembered Rachel and gave her a child. Vayizkor lekim et Bnei Yisrael, remember the Jewish people, took us out of Egypt. Positive, remembering for the future, not just for the past. The idea is, when you pick up this book, whether it's students or adults, whoever it is, you're learning in memory of some, remembering the past, but you're building the future by understanding what role you have to play in Judaism today. The greatest response we can ever give to anti-Semitism is Semitism, is to be proud, knowledgeable, committed Jews. I know for well, and I'm sure you know, in Europe today, it's not a great place to be Jewish. Thank God England's not as bad as Europe. It's a scary place out there. But the thing the anti-Semite wishes to crush is the one thing we can make sure he never can crush, which is our Jewish identity. There's a remarkable, remarkable memo sent by Gestapo HQ, which again is in the book, you can read it, in the essay by Rabbi Y. Rubinstein. It was sent in 1940 from Gestapo HQ in Berlin to Gestapo HQ in Poland with the following message, an absolutely incredible thing. This is from our enemies. They could allow some emigration from Western Europe. Why? They believed the Western European Jews were too assimilated anyway, would basically just drift away. This is before the final solution, by the way. However, from Eastern Europe, no immigration could be allowed because, says the memo, these Jews are just too Jewish. Wherever they will go, they will build again their schools, their synagogues, their communities. No, that we cannot allow. Hitler himself says a remarkable thing. He says the battle for world domination is between two camps alone, the Germans and the Jews. Not the British, not the Americans, not the Russians, no. Germans and Jews. All else is but deception. The Nazis saw the obliteration of the Jewish people as their number one aim. From that Holocaust, I believe, comes an obligation and responsibility of all of us to make sure, not in a negative way, but in a positive way, that we can say proudly and clearly, Am Yisrael Chai. I will leave you with a story that I believe sums up to me this project, and the story, or the indomitable story of our people. And it's a story of one woman, a simple Jewish woman. Her name was Rosa. Rosa was born in 1896 in Galicia, which is now present-day Austria. When she was just 2 years old, her father, who was the rabbi of the community, died. And when she was 12, her mother also passed away. She was left with her two younger sisters to fend for themselves in a very poor shtetl, in a very poor area of modern-day Austria. Eventually, they scraped together a few pennies and moved to the city of Vienna, where there was a bit more chance to get a profession and to get some livelihood for her and her sisters. In her mid-20s, she met Kalman. Kalman was a chazan at one of the local synagogues, and they decided they wanted to get married. But all the money he had was being sent to his new family who moved to this country, to America, and they put off the wedding. Put it off, until in 1938, when Rose was already 38 years old, they decided they should get married. 1938 Austria. In a world about to go mad, two Jewish people made the ultimate commitment to themselves and got married in a shul in Vienna. One of the last weddings to took place in that shul before the Nazis invaded, and of course the Anschluss and terror began for the Jews of Austria. Just before that began, a non-Jewish neighbor of Kalman and Rosa said she had a ticket, a work permit, to get away from here to another country where she thought would be safer for the Jews. But she only had one ticket. She gave it to the young couple and said, you decide who takes it. They discussed it. Does Kalman go or does Rosa go? And in the end, they both decided that she should go with the ticket and he would meet her there. By hook or by crook, he'd find his way there. It was to a country that she had no idea where it was, could not speak the language, had no family, no nothing, but it was a ticket out of the Nazi nightmare. She took it and ended up arriving in Glasgow, Scotland in the winter of 1938. Winters in Scotland are rather bitter, rather cold, and she soon got ill and was taken to hospital with pneumonia, where she found out she was expecting a child. She wrote to Kalman telling him this wonderful news. And he wrote back saying, please look after yourself, I'll be getting as soon as I can. In July 39, she had recovered and the child was born, a baby girl. She wrote to Kalman telling him he was now a father. He wrote a letter in September 39 saying, I've now arrived at the safety of Warsaw, Poland. I'll be joining you soon, dated August 25th, 1939. As everyone knows, 6 days later, the Nazis invaded. She never heard from him again. So there she was, a single mother with a baby girl, trying to raise her in some way in Scotland with no money or no language or no common language. But she was a strong-willed Austrian lady. She was going to make sure her daughter had everything that she wanted her to have. And she made sure that she was comfortable and happy, and the childhood was not exactly rich in money, but rich in experience. When the child turned about 7 or 8, they decided to move to London, where there was a better opportunity for education and slightly warmer weather. And they moved down there, and the child attended the Jewish primary school that just opened there in London. And mother and daughter tried to make ends meet as best they could. Eventually, the daughter found a nice Jewish boy and married. But then the decision came, what about Rosa? She had no family, no friends, no very few friends in London. And the young couple said that she should live with them. And so she became part of the family, and she was part of the family when eventually a grandchild was born to her, and then 3 years later a second grandchild. A few years after that, she contracted, unfortunately, cancer and died peacefully aged 82. The last few years of her life were spent in bliss with her loving family and her two grandchildren. And that was thought to be the end of a wonderful woman's life, with so much goodness as she had done. But go back about 40 years, to 1948, when Rosa and her daughter were listening to a wireless in their home or wherever it was, of the creation of the State of Israel in 48. Rosa turns to her 9-year-old daughter, telling her that one day, either she or her grandchildren eventually would get to be in that land. The two of them then living in a 1-bedroom apartment with no money. It was just a fanciful dream. But she never forgot that dream. And every month, she put aside a little bit of her savings from the government into a fund, which grew and grew and grew, which meant, incredibly, in 1981, when the eldest grandchild became 13, they had enough money to make a trip to Israel for the first time for the family, and bar mitzvah that young boy by the kotel. And the savings stretched to 3 years later, the second child was bar mitzvahed by the kotel in Yerushalayim. Both boys pointed to that seminal trip to Israel as pretty much the reason why they grew up as proud Jews, and why today they're both proud, observant Jews living lives which they believe Rosa would have been proud of. In 1996, almost 100 years to the day when Rosa was born in Galicia, Ariel Achava was born, not in Galicia, but in Yerushalayim, the first immediate member of the family of Rosa to be born in the land of Israel. Some stories, as I said, are too incredibly true. This story is completely true, because if you haven't guessed yet, Rosa was my grandmother. And my brother was the young man in 1981 who committed to the kotel. I was the little boy in 84. And as we speak, I'm waiting for the phone call. My brother is about to, hopefully, please God, give birth to his fifth child in Yerushalayim any day now. The due date is tomorrow. So hopefully there'll be a sixth grade. I've got one, so it'll be 6 great-grandchildren for Rosa. And when I think back to that story, which again, I never knew about, my mother only told me this story, I think, a few years ago, because grandma had said to her, don't ever tell them. That was my gift to them. And she kind of, you know, as a good daughter, felt, you know, and then eventually she thought, you know what, they need to know, they deserve to know. It's a little lady who, in essence, because of her sort of courage and her spirit, has given me so much. And in some ways, when we created this project, I in some ways think that I'm dedicating to her memory. And that is why, I think it's in here, Essay 27, it's called The Long Journey Home, Essay 26, which is the story I've just told you about Rosa Meth, my grandmother. Chicago tonight, I believe, around this table, something very special has started. Because there may only be 10 or 12 of us around this table. But it doesn't take thousands of people to make something magical happen. Rosa Meth was one person, and yet look what she did for my entire family and for the entire community now that her grandchildren are working in. If all of us here realize the power that we have as a nation, the fact we're sitting here in Chicago after what had happened to our people 60 years ago is remarkable. If you'd asked people in 1945 to predict the Jewish people's future, it would have been bleak. The pollsters would have said, forget it. We're never going to rise again from that. And yet, 60 years on, there are more Jews today learning in Jewish day schools across the world than ever before in history. We have, at the same time, the most disastrous rate of assimilation and ignorance in our people at the same time. I give the analogy of Tower Bridge, part of my heritage in London. Tower Bridge is a bridge that is like this. But when there's a big ship, it opens to allow the ship through. The Jewish people is gradually opening, unfortunately. We have to decide which side we're going to be on. Are we going to be on the side of increased commitment, connection, responsibility? Or unfortunately, the other side, which is drifting further away from our heritage? Through this project, remembering the past, remembering every single Jew that no longer have the chance today, but building the future, making sure that we, as responsible Jews of 2006, can take this message to thousands of Jews across the world. And I believe, I've spoken to Zev, and Zev is a person with vision that could power the entire world. But certainly, it's not about stopping here. It's about taking this idea and keeping it going. It's not about 60 years anymore, it's about 6 million. 60 years was the start of it. And from now on, we're going to keep going until as many Jews as we can get across the Jewish world can get involved and can learn and study about their past in order to build their future. The Jewish future, our future. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoy the learning. As I said, it starts tonight for the next 60 days. I myself will be starting again because I always enjoy reading it again. And certainly thanks to Zev, who has brought this project. I mentioned before, why is it Zev? Because when I went to AJOP, I think it was about 10 months ago, Zev said, I will do it in Chicago. I said, and we just met, and I said, Zev, you're my man. And he started, and he's doing a phenomenal job, and hopefully with your help, hundreds more people, I think we've got 500 is our original goal, but I know Zev is thinking far, far bigger than that, and he'll tell you himself what he's thinking of. But it's something that we have to take on. Our responsibility to spread this, because this is an entry point to somebody who's got no connection. Read one essay a day for 60 days. It's so simple, yet it's so powerful. So thank you for listening, and thank you for inviting me, and I hope that's made everything clear. I don't know if it has. And any questions, I'd be happy to take. Thank you.
I'd like to make a statement. Andrew, I think this is